recognizing and self-reflecting, what am I actually good at? And you have to say, like, there's things that I'm not good at. And could I maybe get good at that one day? Maybe. But there are people that are better than me at that. I think people would be surprised to know how little I know how a firm operates, actually, because there are people that can do it for me. So the biggest challenge, I think, is recognizing what you're actually good at. It's also, I think, the biggest path to success.
Welcome to Trial Lawyer View, the podcast dedicated to the fierce yet compassionate lawyers who fight every day for justice in the courtroom. Our guests are top trial lawyers and their firms who share their stories and experiences, offering valuable insights into their journey, as well as expert guests who provide actionable strategies and practical tips for personal injury lawyers looking to optimize their operations, enhance client service, and drive growth in their practices. Trial Lawyer View is brought to you by Synergy. At Synergy, we aren't just a service provider. We are a strategic partner for personal injury law firms, seamlessly integrating with law firms to boost efficiency from day one. Outsourcing cumbersome administrative tasks like lien resolution and Medicare compliance to an expert partner like Synergy enables personal injury firms to focus on what they do best.
Welcome to the Trial Lawyer View podcast. In today's episode, I get the chance to talk with Michael Hill, a remarkable attorney renowned for his groundbreaking achievements in nursing home litigation in Ohio. With an impressive track record of securing 7- and 8-figure trial verdicts and settlements, including record-breaking cases in nursing home abuse, Michael has earned recognition as one of the foremost advocates for victims of severe elder neglect and abuse. His dedication to his practice has garnered him prestigious accolades from super lawyers, the National Trial Lawyers Association, and other trial lawyer organizations, solidifying his status as a preeminent trial lawyer. Michael's commitment to the craft extends beyond the courtroom, as evidenced by his involvement in various professional associations and his role as a faculty member at Trial Lawyer University. With a deep-rooted passion for justice and unwavering commitment to his clients, Michael exemplifies the epitome of legal excellence. In today's episode, we're going to delve into his approach to nursing home cases and his niche practice. Michael, welcome to Trial Lawyer View. Thank you for taking the time to be here with me today.
Absolutely, and thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So I know very few firms in the country specialize in nursing home abuse and neglect cases. Why is that?
Well, it's a really niche practice, number one. And a lot of people, I think, dabble in it a little bit. I know these cases, the reason I'll just give you a little backstory on me, the reason I got into it, is like a lot of lawyers, I was a personal injury lawyer, I did medical malpractice, did some police, a lot of police, you know, civil rights cases, but I'd have a handful of these nursing home abuse cases. And I didn't know how to work them up, really. And I was always told by my firm that these are low value cases. These are sick, old, dying people. Kind of a, what do you expect is going to happen kind of thing. And they looked at these cases, I think like a lot of lawyers do, which is when you calculate the damages, it's life expectancy, it's any future earnings. You know, we don't have any kind of medical bills or economics. So these cases typically settled for, you know, in the low one, you know, low hundreds of thousands of dollars. Maybe a great case was 500 at the tops, but typical cases were probably 1 to 3. And I tried one of these cases. Fortunately, the defense lawyer was one of these people was arrogant and offered so little money that there was no risk on my client. This is back in 2016. You know, and it was a $4.4 million verdict in a jurisdiction where you don't get a lot of verdicts, especially back then. And so it just hit me that look, maybe lawyers think a certain way about it, but the jury doesn't. And so from there, it became a focus of mine. And I had started my own firm at that point. And I'm another firm of mine. And so for the last 7 years, it's all I've done. And I think as I've gotten into it more, I've realized how much different it is than medical malpractice or any kind of personal injury. In fact, I think it's a lot more like trucking cases than it is anything else because it's so regulatory driven, so systems driven, so much coming, you know, the negligence has always come from the top down for budgetary reasons, profit motives, et cetera. So it has a lot of similarities to the trucking cases more than anything else. And so then having that specialty, of course, as you can imagine, a lot of people refer me cases. So there's no reason to get outside of that niche at this point. And it's just something that I've fallen in love with.
You know, it's interesting, the concept of, you know, these corporations like trucking corporations that oftentimes put profits ahead of safety. And the sad part about what you do is that you have corporations putting profits ahead of people, and it's the elderly who are our grandparents or parents or brother or sister, and that holding them accountable is, there's incredible value to that just from a societal perspective. Sorry, I'm offering my own opinion there, but I agree.
And that's what I always hear from clients as well, because, you know, they don't have anyone to turn to. There aren't many people that do this. And they also have this, usually this intense sense of grief because, you know, they're questioning themselves. Why did I choose this facility? Why didn't I get them out of there sooner? You know, they're going through all the kind of the what if game at this point. And so, you know, that becomes something that I think the jury resonates with, because we don't have a good system in this country for our elderly. A lot of countries do it very well. We don't. And these are very complex patients that, you know, they can't live in your house. They need to be, you know, a lot of care, a lot of assistance. So this is our only option, usually, because who has the money to self-pay for 24-hour around-the-clock nursing, right? You're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. So this is our only option. And so when you get in front of a jury, I think that they understand that most of our hands are tied. And if this could happen to this person or that person or this person at a nursing home, it could easily happen to their parent or them in 10 years or their neighbor. So I think a lot of the motivation for these cases in terms of the large verdicts are less about the specifics of the client sometimes and more about the fact that it's obvious that this is just the result of an overall problem that we have. It was going to happen to somebody. It's probably happening to lots of people. This is an example of the problem, and jurors want to change that system, and this is the only way that we can.
You had mentioned about valuation of these cases and the damages, and I know that there's variables from state to state, because, for example, here in Florida, I know we have some pretty, what I would consider, draconian laws, and there's it's hard to hold the companies responsible, and there's limits on damages, and I know, you know, that's different jurisdictionally, but I'm just curious how you view all of that through the lens of representing people that are in these situations where there is that devalue, whether it's, you know, the corporation or whether it's legislatively in states, because that to me is just important. I mean, the caps on damages in general to me just, you know, until it's your family member that becomes the victim of someone else's negligence, it may look good to the legislature, but man, when it's your own family, then it becomes personal. You understand why devaluing the elderly when there's not economic damages or a minor child, for example. I mean, those are just, you know, great examples of how sometimes these cases are devalued simply because of the lack of economics.
No, absolutely. And just speaking on caps for a moment, you know, one of the interesting things is a lot of my clients, you know, who vote for people that have instituted these caps, they have no idea that they exist, and they're shocked to find out. You know, they were sold the story of the need for tort reform and frivolous cases and those things, and they're looking at me going, "Well, wait, this is a real case, right? Why is mine capped?" And go, "Well, that's kind of what caps are for. They're really not for the frivolous cases; they're for the real cases, because those are the ones that generate money." But from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, it's wildly different. You know, Florida, for wrongful death cases like this, it's difficult. For you go to California, and it makes zero sense, because if it's a skilled nursing facility or a nursing home, you're looking at a hard cap of like $250,000. But if it's a assisted living facility attached to the nursing home, they don't have those caps. There's none. So it really makes no sense from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. The reality is where it is really draconian, like Texas, for example, people don't practice there. And when they do, it becomes, you know, necessary for these lawyers to really have kind of a churn and burn approach. And it's not because they're bad lawyers. It's not because they don't want to work up the case. It's that if you got a cap at $250,000, you're never going to get more than that. They're never going to give you that, probably, for a settlement. And the more you work up the case, the more you burn your client's funds. So the reality of it is, you know, as much as we'd like to change the system, that has to come from a legislative issue. There are no economic damages by and large in these cases, just the natural consequence of it. It's so strange. You know, I have a good friend of mine who practices in Milwaukee and does a lot of these cases, but they also have cases in Illinois. And that imaginary line, you know, 50 miles apart or whatever they are, it's a completely different situation on part of that line, what side of that line it happens to you. But the reality is that, you know, we have to be very careful of where we take these cases. You know, and I, you know, if it's a Texas case or something like that, the reality is, you know, I'm probably not going to be able to take it. It's going to be referred out. You know, I'm a trial lawyer. I try a lot of cases per year. I try somewhere in the range of 6 to 10 cases a year. And economically, it just doesn't make sense for the client because, you know, it ends up being a paper verdict at that point because there's nothing left for them, even if they do get the maximum recovery. And I don't think that, you know, I am trying to work with some organizations to get the message out, but, you know, the hands that be have done such a great job over time, you know, expressing the need for tort reform and why this is so important. It's really been embedded in our legislation at this point that no one's really thinking about it. It just is that case. So it's going to be more than an uphill battle to get that overturned.
You touched on it a little bit, but I wanted to ask really more personally for you, since you and your firm have handled thousands or over 1,000 nursing home abuse and neglect cases, why dedicate yourself in your life to helping families impacted by these types of situations?
Yeah, I think it really comes down to, I don't think anybody else will, is really what it comes down to. I don't have any personal experience with nursing homes in my everyday life. I never had a family member in a nursing home. Until I started doing this, I never set foot in a nursing home. And so at the end of the day, I think it's like a lot of lawyers that do this kind of work. You really fall in love with your clients and you fall in love with the story. And looking around, there are so few people that specialize in this. It's something when I look at my clients, there's no one else to turn to. There's lots of great lawyers who do medical malpractice day in and day out. There's lots of great lawyers who devote their life to trucking cases and product liability, et cetera. You don't see as much of that in the nursing home industry, or at least in our field going after the nursing home industry, that it's one of those situations where I kind of feel like, you know, if I'm not doing it, who will? Essentially.
Yeah, I feel very similar about, you know, what we do, because it's a of that similar vein, right? It's about how can we positively impact people. You know, in your situation, it's all about those people that come through your door and what can you do given what's transpired. And some of those stories are just, you know, horrible. And, you know, you feel for the family that's been put through something just incredibly tragic. And I was going to ask you, because you've got a very large verdict that made nursing home abuse headlines in your home state. If I remember correctly from doing the research, it was the single largest verdict against a nursing home in Ohio history. And I was curious if you could share maybe a couple of strategies or tactics you employed to reach the jurors so that they understood why justice and fairness dictated a result like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the first key to that case and cases like this in general is the nurse or the aides are not the bad guys in this situation. I think that's the first mistake that a lot of lawyers make, is you go after this nurse to say, well, why didn't you do this thing? You have a patient, et cetera. They're oftentimes the victims in this as well. And that's why I compare it to the trucking cases, because a lot of times the truck driver has no other choice, right? He's trying to make do. He's got coming from the top down. So it's very similar. So the first thing I try to do in these cases is contact former employees and get them to testify early in the case. They're the most credible witnesses. They've got no stake in the outcome. In fact, they're potentially putting their own livelihood in jeopardy because they're speaking publicly about people in the community, nursing homes in the community, et cetera. And they're often talking about the neglect that they were forced to, you know, undertake, that they were forced to not take care of patients, that they were forced to falsify records, that they were forced, I mean, and all of this stuff comes out in these cases and in that case. And the reason that's also, I think, very important is when I say that they're the victim in this, you know, each one of these cases takes place in a specific community and you've got jurors on that community. So they have a duty to be looking out, not just for the client here or the decedent, but they're also looking at the impact these companies are having on their community. That case was in, you know, Warren, Ohio, which is a blue collar working class area that I think now it would like to be called a working class area. It was a steel town, factory town, GM town, and everything had moved out. There are very few opportunities. So in that case, I had, you know, the first few witnesses testifying that they were making somewhere in the range of $10 an hour, $9 an hour. They didn't want to work there, but they had kids at home, you know, disabled children, whatever it might be. They've got to put food on the table and they would cry every night when they would leave the job because they're not able to take care of these patients, but they have no other choice. And when you have jurors looking at that, looking at the outside in, it becomes now they're motivated to do things for two different reasons. One is you're coming into our community from another state, most likely, and you're really sucking out all of our resources and grinding our people to dust. Right? We're getting nothing out of it from an economic standpoint. And you're also taking horrible advantage of people in our community who need you to take care of them, who are likely to be like you and me. So that's the first part of the case is, you know, the staff are often victims and get those staff to testify early. If you can do that, the case really shifts in your direction because the defense is left in this very difficult situation where they have two options. One is convince the jury not to believe these former employees, okay, because they're liars and they're coming in and testifying, et cetera. But then they also have to explain why these people worked there and took care of these very vulnerable people. So it really still takes the thunder out of them. And you can see the defense flat-footed. They don't really have a plan for what to do. And like anything else, it's social proof. And we know that from a lot of psychology. The more that you can get people to testify, you can stack it. It's why we like Amazon reviews, Google reviews. One, you go, all right, that's a little suspect. Maybe one person is kind of full of it. But two, that's a little bit more likely. Three, four, five, six, seven. You know, you see 7 1-star reviews and no 5-star reviews, right? And go, I don't know if I want this product. Like, they can't all be wrong. I think a former employee is the same way. And so getting that out there early and making cases very simple, leaving out the nursing home jargon, limiting your expert testimony, and getting things done quickly. You know, when I was a lawyer starting out, our cases, you know, medical malpractice cases took a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And witnesses were on for a very long time. You know, I try to get these cases done. In that case, for example, I think there were 20 some witnesses. I think the entire case was done probably in 2.5 days worth of testimony. So make it efficient is the other thing, because one, our attention spans are terrible and lawyers are not as interesting as we think we are. We're interesting to ourselves, but it doesn't go far beyond that. So, you know, get the jury the information, get it to them quickly. Don't repeat yourself. And really make it about the lay people who are involved here, seen firsthand, and not about the experts. And I think you're in very good shape. And I think that probably applies to a lot of different kinds of cases.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, an incredible outcome. I assume, you know, partly due to, I don't know the specific facts, but partly due to the egregious nature of it, but also quality of client and all those things that kind of go into making what usually is a, you know, a record-breaking verdict like that.
Yeah, and these cases tend to have photographs. You know, we're talking about bed sores. We're talking about some pretty, and this was a horrible case of neglect where, I mean, there were bed sores on his ears, for example. He looked like he'd been in a concentration camp. You know, his toenails were so long. You know, they were painful. They were digging into it. I mean, he couldn't walk basically because no one had cut his toenails for so long. So the neglect was egregious. Those photographs just seeing those, they tell you neglect happened. You don't really have to hear much more. I mean, you hear a couple of employees say how bad it was. You look at those photographs and there's not much left to be done, in my opinion. And I think what we can do as lawyers more than anything else is get in our own way and overcomplicate things. And the story's there. We just have to bring the story out.
In doing my preparation for the podcast, I heard you talk about and I think we just talked about a little bit, the satisfaction of representing a family that's been harmed in that way and helping them get justice. And that, you know, outcome of the jury telling a nursing home corporation that they did something wrong, that idea of justice-based mission really resonates with me, given our similarity of the mission here at Synergy. And I do a lot of speaking about that to our team. I'm curious how that kind of mission approach developed in you and how you bring that mission to every person that's involved in your law firm to ultimately deliver for your clients.
Yeah, so we have, and I think this is very similar to what your organization does as well. I mean, you've got a very niche practice. It's large, but it's niche. And the first thing that my staff needs to do to understand is that we're one of the very few firms in the country that does only this. And we need to be the best at this in everything we do. That means that we have to be as efficient as possible in everything we do. What I've really tried to make our mission is to get the best results for our clients, but also have the best customer service that we can for our clients. We are in a service industry, right? As fancy as we think we are as law firms and lawyers, it's a service industry. And I think that, and what I realized is, you know, at firms I'd worked in the past that were very good law firms, they didn't keep their clients up to date. They may have been doing good work, but the client didn't know that. And so it is routine. It's not daily, but it's you know, close to daily. Whenever anything happens, we're contacting our clients. We're letting them know. They need that, I think, as much as a positive result. They are looking to us, you know, to help heal them from probably the worst thing that's ever happened in their life, right? We are really hand in hand with them. So I think we as lawyers, I know the number one bar complaint is that lawyers don't keep their clients updated. So making that effort to do that, to put our clients number one, that has been, I think, the biggest focus. And what's happened as a result of that is you have so much client control, I think is the wrong word, so much trust from your clients. And I hear from mediators who talk about lawyers not having any control over their clients. I hear about lawyers complaining about their clients so much, how much they dislike their clients. We haven't had that at all because our clients don't have a reason to. They're kept up to date all the time. And the upside of that is it allows us to try so many cases because our clients are so motivated to do it. They see what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. They see this trial kind of coming into view, looking ahead. They're not fearful, right? They're willing to go with us. They trust us completely. You know, they're turning down, you know, very, very large settlement offers because they're lockstep with us. They have no reason to distrust us in any way. So I think it really is, and not just customer service from that standpoint, but also the fact that, you know, we have this weird situation as plaintiff's lawyers where we just parachute into people's lives. You know, I spend a lot of time, I can't tell you how many dinners I've had with clients and the entire family, and the stuff I know about these people that they're so willing to share is incredible to me. And you have, like I always say, like a backstage pass to these people's lives. I know more about a lot of these people than I do, frankly, a lot of people in my own family. And when they give you that level of trust, there's no, and you form that connection, there's nothing you're not going to do for them. Right? You're not going to say, oh, it's late at night, I'm tired, let me go to bed, I'm not going to work on this kind of thing. So bringing the clients to the forefront of everything we do, making our staff know that that's our absolute mission is to have the best customer service of any law firm that's out there. That has been probably the biggest difference that I've had in these, in my cases, and has just maximized everything that we do. And I relate that back to you because, you know, your company has made things so seamless for what we do. And I'll go back to the specialization a little bit. You know, when I look out there and I see people dabbling in these cases, and sometimes they do a very good job, but they're learning it as they go. It takes up so much of their time. And I kind of look at it and go, well, that you can refer that and get probably better results and not have to learn it across the way. And I relate that to your organization because I'm sure a lot of people tell you, well, we can do it in-house and we do a good job. But again, it's not your probably highest and best use of your time. So I kind of related a little bit to what you do or any niche field for that matter.
It's very much analogous to that. I think, you know, any lawyer that dabbles in an area that they don't typically practice in, obviously that always presents a malpractice trap, but two, it's usually not in the best interest of them and their practice. They're much better off referring it to a lawyer like you who practices day in, day out in that area, just like same thing with liens. It's interesting though, one of the things that you talked about, one of our previous guests had talked about, which was customer experience. Same as Joey Coleman, he wrote a book, Never Lose a Customer Again. And a lot of what, and he's actually a former practicing attorney. He didn't do personal injury work, but he was just talking about the fact that bar complaints, the highest percentage come from failure to communicate. So it was just interesting to hear you talk about that, because that is such an important thing in terms of customer experience, whether it's on our end communicating what's going on. We developed a whole electronic portal just so our clients would know exactly what's going on whenever they want to see it, but also that written verbal communication. How have you guys approached that? Have you used technology yet to do any of that, or is it still the old fashioned just calling the clients and making sure that they understand what's going on and what comes next?
It's a mix of both. Our clients really range in their age. And that can make a big difference. You know, if we've got, for example, a grandchild who's maybe in their 20s or 30s, they're much more adept at technology. They're used to receiving updates by text, email, et cetera. And depending on people's level of sophistication with technology, that continues with age, of course, as well. But what we see is when it's a sibling or a spouse, or some of our clients are 100 years old, so their children might be in their 70s as well. You know, those emails are fine, but they still want that human contact, right? They appreciate that phone call. And what I tell my staff is, you know, that 5-minute phone call that took almost none of your time, that has probably kept them at peace for the next 30 days. And it is a bit of a, hey, I'm not going to hear from that client because they're satisfied. But on the other end of that, they're satisfied, which is what we want. And so I try to do it, you know, with a mix. We try to keep good notes on how clients want to be contacted. So we're able to work with them on that. But we don't have any kind of a standardized, this is the only way we do it. We really try to do it as a mix and try to do it in a way that best suits our clients. Now, we don't have thousands of clients, like some of these very large firms. You know, we've got at any time probably in the range of 40 to 100 clients. So it's easier for us, I think, than a lot of larger firms to have that specialized approach based on the client.
Yeah, I know that for many years you worked within other established firms, and you now have started your own practice, which, you know, sitting out on your own is always a bold move. I do remember that from when I started Synergy. I'm curious about what ultimately motivated you to start your own firm, and then what were the top three challenges you encountered along the way once you did start your firm?
And I think this is the reason that a lot of people start their own businesses, is we have probably that spirit where we want to have absolute control, right? I think that's number one, right? And it's not arrogance or anything else. It's just the way that we are. I think a lot of people who are, whether they own a law firm or, you know, they're a physician or the head of a physician organization or the CEO of a company, you have that spirit where you want to take risks, you want to succeed. You have staff that you delegate to, but you want to ultimately be the one who has the say. So I think that's probably the first thing. And when I say have the say, I don't mean that from an arrogant standpoint, like you don't want to listen to people, but you want to control the direction of how things are going. For example, you know, I was in a partnership for a long time with another individual, and you don't have that say necessarily about customer service and how things go, so you butt heads. So that's the ultimate reason. The second, I would say, but the most challenging parts of it, I think, are recognizing what we're good at and what we're not good at. And there are some lawyers who are great at the business side of things. And I know lawyers who are great at the business side of things. That's not me. Okay. I'm good with clients. I'm good in trial. I'm good at some things, but I'm not a business person by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I'm the kind of person who their profit and loss statement is basically a general idea in the back of their head for how things are going. So finding the right people to fill those roles for you and allow you to do the things you're actually good at is both the biggest challenge, but it ends up being, you know, and recognizing and self-reflecting, what am I actually good at? And you have to say, like, there's things that I'm not good at. And could I maybe get good at that one day? Maybe. But there are people that are better than me at that. So finding, you know, whether it's the CFO, the CEO, the fractionals that are out there, a lot of them, unbelievably helpful. I think people would be surprised to know how little I know how a firm operates, actually, because there are people like that can do it for me. And then there are people across the board who could do it for anybody. And that doesn't mean you have to hire a full-time CFO, a full-time CEO, anything like that. You know, there are a million project managers out there that can help you. So the biggest challenge, I think, is recognizing what you're actually good at. It's also, I think, the biggest path to success as well. And again, I don't want to come back to synergy and talk about it all the time, but again, that's why we outsource as much as we can. There are specialists in these things, right? There's whether it's liens, whether it's ordering medical records, whether it's organizing medical records. There are all these different organizations out there that have dedicated themselves to that specific service. And I ask my staff, why would we do that, right? Freeing yourself up from doing those things allows us to do the thing that we're actually good at. What are we good at? We're good at being trial lawyers and getting cases ready for trial. We've never once bragged that we're good at negotiating liens, right? We don't see that on our website, right? We're great at that or anything else, right, that's ancillary to what we do. So that is the biggest challenge, but it's also, I think, the biggest path to success. And from my perspective, the other challenge I'll just say is kind of a bit of a bleeding heart. My biggest challenge is not taking on too many cases, right? Because I have to have somebody to kind of check me because I will take on some of the cases that are so unlikely to be successful just because you speak to somebody, oh, I want to help them. And then you get in that situation where now you're actually not able to, not only can you not help them, but you're spreading yourself so thin that you're actually not able to help the people that you can. So that's the other part, again, knowing my limitations and what I'm good at and what I'm not good at.
Incredibly insightful. You know, the idea of how do you run your law firm in the most efficient and profitable manner boils down to the basics of running any business, which is knowing your strengths, surrounding yourself with a team that is there for, you know, you to make sure that ultimately everything is done the right way. And that all the things you talked about are things I think for whatever reason have been overlooked to some extent in a lot of personal injury practices, running the firm as a business. That doesn't mean that you're not a trial lawyer, but if you're not the right person to be CEO or CFO, then you need to have someone on your team that's looking at those things to make sure that the firm is operating soundly from a business perspective, which ties back into how do you, you know, ultimately deliver customer experience. If the business is not run well from a business perspective, it still is hard to deliver the right kinds of outcomes because the business may not be investing in ways that it should be to deliver on those customer experiences. So kudos to you for that and recognizing that, because I think it seems like there's more of a wave now towards that. There's a lot of more seminars than there used to be on just the idea of running a personal injury practice efficiently, profitably. But the outsourcing part is also a great point, you know, making sure that your firm focuses on what it ultimately needs to do, and that's deliver for your clients.
It really hit me. So I worked at personal injury practice for my entire career, and it was a bit of we do everything, right? The client calls and you pick up the phone directly to you. And, you know, you kind of do every aspect of negotiating liens and anything else. And my stepfather had to have open heart surgery at the Cleveland Clinic. And it was a massive surgery. They had to take his heart out. Just one of those situations that basically rebuild it. And the actual surgeon, the cardiologist or cardiac surgeon, came in halfway through the procedure. They had already cut him and opened him up. And that was his role. He came in and did that. He was the expert at that very specific thing and left. And it just hit me when I'm sitting in the hospital is that why do we not run our businesses, law firms, like medical facilities? Cleveland Clinic's providing a great experience, but they're doing that by that doctor doing the thing that he is actually good at and needed for. So what I've tried to do since then is the lawyers in my law firm need to be doing things that you need to be a lawyer to do. And if you don't need to be a lawyer to do this thing, you shouldn't be doing it, right? So lawyers need to be in trial, depositions, and mediations. I don't know what else really requires a lawyer, I guess reviewing discovery. But outside of that, there's someone else who should be doing it. You know, I've never called my doctor's office and my doctor's the one who picks up the phone, or I say, hey, can I talk to Dr. Smith? And they go, yeah, hold on, let me give you to him right now. It doesn't work that way. So I've tried to run it as much as I can. And I think that, like you said, I mean, outside of personal injury, I think a lot of organizations have recognized this. But it just hit me one day. So that's kind of my model when I go back to it. I just ask myself, wait, do I need an actual law degree to be doing this thing? Do I need to be a licensed lawyer? If not, somebody else can do it.
I think you've already alluded to it, but I wanted to just ask you directly. You made the decision to partner with Synergy for Healthcare Lien Resolution. How is that strategic partnership streamlined your firm's operations, and what benefits have you seen for the firm and ultimately for the clients?
We're not experts in lien resolution. We don't have people on our staff who worked for Rawlings and all these other companies and know the ins and outs. We're always going to be novices. We're not going to have insider information. And we could spend, you know, probably hours doing things to try to negotiate a lien and read whatever statute and whatever else exists that you all know at the tip of your tongue, right? It's boom, it's right here. So finding people who can do that frees up our staff's time dramatically. You know, we're not chasing down liens. We're not trying to negotiate things through Medicare. When Medicare and their portal makes a mistake, we're not the ones trying to get on the phone with Medicare and get these things figured out. So it's freed up our staff's time immensely. And the process of opening up, you know, a case with you all is, I mean, it's just, there's nothing to it. And you handle everything basically soup to nuts. So it's, in addition to my staff not doing that thing, it's also something that we don't have to worry about, right? It's not even in the back of our minds. It's we'll get it to you, start the case, and then well, once the case is over, basically we're following up, right? We're just checking it out. So it's freed up a ton of our staff time. And I don't think that, you know, without organizations like Synergy, when I say organization, you're the only lien resolution company that we work with. But without other kind of outsourcing like that, we just simply wouldn't be able to do the things that we do. When we did do a lot of our own lien resolution, you know, it was always difficult to explain that to clients, what exactly was happening, how we were doing it, because we're not experts at it. And it's one of those things, you remind myself of this, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should be doing that thing. And so, you know, it is just streamlined our practice, and just taken off this thing that doesn't make us money, this thing that doesn't, provide us any joy, this thing that really isn't benefiting the clients when we're doing it ourselves, and handed that over to somebody that has expertise. And to me, it's a no-brainer, and we'll never go back. There's no question about that.
It's very smart to look at your business, componentized in the way you were talking about too, where medical record retrieval, you know, organization and summarization of medical records. Those are two areas, other areas where we do see a lot of law firms taking advantage of outsourcing solutions, because it just makes more sense to have others or technology do things that, you know, otherwise you have your staff, and it could be lawyer time or it could be paralegal time tied up in what is truly administrative work, which doesn't benefit the next client. The more of that you offload, the more efficient you can handle, efficiently you can handle the cases that are in the inventory to move those towards resolution, which is what your clients want.
Exactly. And, you know, from the lawyer standpoint or the law firm standpoint, in the personal injury world, not only are you freeing up your staff's time to do things that are more valuable for your clients and for your firm, you know, these are recoverable expenses. You're not eating up overhead to do this. You're not bringing, you know, you're not spending a lot of time doing that, paying staff. And I think, you know, as personal injury lawyers, or anybody doing contingency work, you know, you have to be thinking about how can we keep overhead down any way that we can. And so, again, you know, that's one of the benefits of Synergy is it isn't, you know, outsourcing it. It's a client expense.
Well, and I mean, it's just like any business, right? Keeping overhead down is part of just the basics of business, because the more profitable you are, the better you can serve, because you have more money to invest in continuing to improve services. And as a business, part of what, you know, drives everything is that profit. So it's a very important part of running a business is looking at that and making sure that ultimately you're doing what you need to do as a business owner from that standpoint. I wanted to, before we wrap up, ask you a little bit about Trial Lawyer University, because I know that you're a faculty member, and I'm curious about what you feel like you give to others and what you get back from being involved in that kind of teaching atmosphere for the craft that I'm sure you hold very dear, considering how much you're in trial. So I'm curious about that.
Yeah. So I think it's one, I would break it up in two ways. One, what I can give to the community, and also what I get out of it being around a lot of these people. So the first part I'd say is that, you know, a lot of people, and I would have been the same way early on in my career, you may want to do these things, but a lot of people don't have available resources to them. They're just not there. They don't have a mentor, you know, in their organization, or they don't have somebody who's an expert in these things. So, you know, I do a lot of, for example, I've got a master class. This will have already come out of this podcast, but I've got a master class, 2 days, and then 2 days of workshops in Huntington Beach. And then in September coming up, I've got, you know, I think a 4-day track. And then in Vegas, you know, on October. And people ask me, aren't you giving away the secret sauce? And I go, yeah, absolutely. Of course I am, right? I want people to be good at this. And what I think we've all learned, or if we pay attention, is that people who are successful, they really have an abundance mentality, which is that the more we give, right, you're never going to run out of cases, right? You're never going to run out of these great cases. They're everywhere. Unfortunately, for society, there's going to be tons of nursing home cases. So I want people to do it at a high level. And then when you're teaching, like anything else, you know, you're not getting stuck in your own ways, right? You're constantly then reading books. What's the best way? What can I add the next time I teach, right? I don't want to be giving this people the same exact thing every time, you know, I'm speaking to them. So you're always pushing yourself to learn. So that's kind of what you get out of it, you know, in terms of reaching out to people and providing that information and doing the teaching and lecturing, et cetera. And then, you know, also I'm hoping that, you know, I'm a big believer in, you know, rising tides, you know, benefit everybody. So if somebody I've worked with, you know, or whatever has followed some strategies that I provided and they get a larger settlement or a larger verdict, that helps all of us. Because, you know, it helps to break that algorithm that insurance companies have had over years, that these are low value cases. And we are seeing that break. What I get out of it is not just the teaching aspect, but you're putting yourself in a situation where you're spending time with the best in the fields. And these might not be, you know, these might not be nursing home lawyers. I think I'm the only one in TLU, but trucking, you know, and I would list out the names, but I don't want to name drop, but these are the tops in the fields. And when you're spending time with people like that, you know, you get a different mentality. Right, you start to see things differently. You start to feel different about yourself. Right, the goals that you have change. You know, when you're spending time with people that are getting 9-figure verdicts, you know, your 8-figure verdicts don't look that great anymore. That's what you start to strive to become. And I'm really a big believer in, you know, you are kind of the culmination of the 5 people you spend the most time with. And so getting out there and spreading yourself and challenging yourself, it really improves you because it just changes your kind of your baseline that you settle at. It goes up, right? So it's one, me giving back. It's me having the enjoyment of teaching people, and hopefully they're taking that and helping people and getting bigger verdicts. But I also get a lot out of it too, just of the people that I spend a lot of time with and hearing their insights and just kind of changing my mentality.
One of the beautiful things about this specific area of practice is that mentality amongst many trial lawyers and how there's that sharing to help each other in the craft, because for all the reasons that you stated. So if anyone that's listening to the podcast is interested in the master classes that you mentioned, where would they go to find more information about participating in those?
Yeah, so I think one is Trial University. They have a great website that lists everything. I think the other thing is just feel free to drop me a line. I'm always surprised how often, you give out your information and people don't contact you. And it's funny because when you do reach out to people, it really is the more successful it seems people are, the more likely are to return your call, right? People that you would think like, oh, they would never get back to me. And you send it to the top person in the field and they respond immediately. So just shoot me an email, at michael.hill@protectseniors.com. And I'm happy to talk to anybody about anything. I always say, drop me a line. One of my favorite things to do is when, somebody's got a trial coming up and they go, hey man, can I borrow you for a couple hours and frame the case and see what we're doing? Is the right strategy? I love that more than anything else. So I encourage anybody to drop me a line, and take it from there.
So, last question. Really more or less open mic for you, since the podcast is Trial Lawyer View. It's what's your view as a trial lawyer? So you can talk about whatever you want to close us out.
And this is going to sound a little bit strange, I think, but as trial lawyers, I think that we forget that despite everything we do, we're in the business of sales. We really are. And I don't mean just selling ourselves to juries or anything else, but I have a lot of what I've done in terms of learning how to be a trial lawyer has really been based on sales. So, and I have no sales background, but based on sales seminars, it's been based on a lot of things that are outside what we would consider like traditional trial lawyer education. A lot of things that involve psychology, a lot of things that involve business. We're not in a vacuum here, right? And we tend to think we are. And we only look at trial lawyer stuff and trial lawyer guides and CLEs. Opening things up and seeing how other people do things at a high level really just expands your way of thinking. And so I can tell you so much what I do in trial is not stuff that I learned from any kind of trial lawyer seminar or anything like that. It's things like Grant Cardone seminar sales. Right? Because they are attractive, convincing people, right? They have a way of speaking that draws people in. They figured this out. That's how sales works, right? They've got to make an impression immediately, right? They've got to close that. So that's the biggest thing I would say from the trial lawyer view is get yourself outside of just speaking to lawyers, outside of learning from lawyers, expand. So that I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Michael. And we'll include Michael's contact information in the show notes today, along with some links to the Trial Lawyer University master classes. Michael, thanks for taking the time to join me today on Trial Lawyer View, and we'll see everybody on the next episode.
Thanks so much.
Here is another episode of Trial Lawyer View. We hope you enjoy today's guest and discussion. Tune in to our next episode for more helpful insights from fellow trial lawyers and practice experts. This podcast is brought to you by Synergy. Visit partnerwithsynergy.com to learn more about how Synergy can free your firm to focus on what it does best.